For a period of about 50 years, right in the middle of the American century, many of the nation's top comic strip cartoonists, gag cartoonists, and magazine illustrators lived within a stone's throw of one another in the southwestern corner of Connecticut, a bit of Bohemia in the middle of those men in their gray flannel suits. Cullen Murphy's father, John Cullen Murphy, drew the wildly popular comic strips Prince Valiant and Big Ben Bolt, and was at the heart of this artistic milieu. Cullen Murphy has just written a book about his dad and about Cartoon County. The name of the book is Cartoon County, My Father and His Friends in the Golden Age of Make-Believe. He'll be having an event this Saturday at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Cullen Murphy to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, great to be with you, Joe.
So give us a sense at what point you knew you wanted to write about your father and the impact that his art had, and really that his impact had on art geographically.
The first thing to know is that my father, who drew two comic strips, one of which was a prize-fighting strip called Big Ben Bolt, and then an adventure strip called Prince Valiant, was part of a very large community that existed in Connecticut in the 50s and 60s and 70s of cartoonists and illustrators. There must have been 100 or 150 of them, all clustered in Fairfield County and adjacent regions. And it was quite a bohemian subculture there. And this was the world in which my brothers and sisters and I grew up in, you know, as did the children of many other cartoonists. And it's a world that most people have no idea ever existed. You know, everybody knows the comic strips. Everybody knows Beetle Bailey and Hagar the Horrible and High and Lois and Prince Valiant. But they don't know anything about the people who made them. And they certainly don't know that a huge proportion of them, you know, all lived together, you know, within a few miles of each other, socialized together, and were very much part of a, you know, a close-knit culture. So I was aware when I was much younger that this was something very special, but as I grew older, it became clear that this was something that, of course, it's largely disappeared by now, but was something that was worth holding on to and trying to memorialize. And as I watched many of the cartoonists, you know, go on to their rewards, and my father himself died in 2004, the idea of attempting to bring this community to life in book form grew very strong.
So one of the fascinating aspects of this, and of course one of the key questions, is how did this community develop in the sense of what brought all of these very talented people who had long-lasting, talented careers, what brought them together in this one place?
There were a lot of things that all came together. And the first thing to know is that it's a phenomenon of the post-war era. So you had a lot of artists who had been through the war. Many of them had learned their craft during the war. They were in their 20s when the war was over. They were starting families. The cartoon, comic strip, and illustration industry, such as it was based in New York, so they had to be close to New York. But it wasn't necessarily a great place to raise your family from their point of view, so they began looking outside of New York. A lot of artists had already migrated out to Westchester. You know, Norman Rockwell lived in Westchester, for instance, before he moved up to Vermont and then to Stockbridge. But a place like Westchester was too expensive for young people starting families, so they looked even further, and Connecticut was close by, and Connecticut did not have an income tax, so that was a big plus, unlike New Jersey and New York. And it was on the railroad line to Manhattan. It was only about an hour away, so they could get in and do what they needed to do in Manhattan. And, unbelievably, you know, if you have an image of, you know, Greenwich and Westport and that neck of the woods these days, which all seems to be filled with you know, hedge fund millionaires, back then, in the late 40s, it was a pretty quiet patch of territory. And, you know, towns like Greenwich were filled with teachers and plumbers and electricians, as well as people on their on their estates. So it was a very different world, and it was affordable. And once you had, you know, 10 or 20 of these people moving out there, it began to look very attractive. You know, you go out there, you buy your small house, there's a lot of other people doing what you're doing. And before long, by the mid-1950s, you've got scores and scores of them all living there.
How established was the community when your father moved in?
He got in very early, and he bought a house in Greenwich in 1953. And there were a few people who had already moved out there. I believe Mort Walker, who did Beetle Bailey and created High and Lois, was there already. He wasn't the first to move out there, but he was one of the first. And one of the reasons he moved out there was because he knew that there were, you know, others of his peculiar ilk already living there. And throughout the 50s, it just grew, you know, more and more populous.
Was it, how much of your father, where was he in his career as far as the strips and their run at the point of his moving into Connecticut?
In 1953, he would have been 34 years old. He had started out as an illustrator at a very early age. He'd gone to the Art Students League in the mid-1930s. He got a scholarship thanks to Norman Rockwell, who was his next-door neighbor in New Rochelle when he was growing up, and taught him quite a lot, and had begun selling illustrations to national magazines even before the war. So this was when he was, you know, 20, 21 years old. The war, of course, was a big interruption for everybody, but he drew throughout the war. He was on the staff of General MacArthur in the Pacific. He was used by various generals to, you know, do portraits of other people in the military. And on his own, he painted, you know, scenes of warfare and of scenery and of people. He really got an extraordinary education as an artist during the war, as many cartoonists did. And when he mustered out and returned to the New York area, he continued work as an illustrator. But his work about unboxing, he did a lot of stuff for Madison Square Garden, attracted the attention of a writer of comic strips named Elliot Kaplan, who was the brother of Al Cap, and he signed him up to do a strip, and that was Big Ben Bolt, and that was, you know, around 1950 or so. So from that moment on, he was always doing comic strips, even though he continued to do other forms of illustration throughout his life.
When it comes to the strips, Prince Valiant was incredibly popular. It was a very popular strip.
It was indeed. And these days, it's hard to reconstruct just what a central place in our culture the funny pages held. They don't have that position any longer, and they've been brushed aside by, you know, television and photography, and of course nowadays by the internet. But in the mid-20th century, and, you know, decades before then, they were a huge cultural phenomenon. You know, in my day, on a Sunday, you might get as many as 16 pages of full-color comics. You know, that was something like, you know, 65 square feet of comics. And you might have, you know, 50 different comics in those pages. You know, they were so big that if you were 6 or 7 years old, you couldn't sit in a chair and read the comics. You had to put them down on the floor, you know, the way you imagine kids reading comics. But it was very, very real. And cartoonists as a group, even though people didn't know the creators as individuals, you know, unlike actors or actresses, nobody really knew anything about the creators. But their works were so well known, and collectively they had a great convening power. They could, you know, when they held events, you know, sports figures would come, politicians would come, people in the movie industry would come. So that phenomenon and that dynamic is one of the things I've tried to capture in the book just how big a deal it was.
How aware and supportive were the cartoonists with each other in the sense of sharing work, sharing ideas, and awareness of what the others were doing?
They were very aware. This was a very close-knit group. Each person had his own work, of course, and it was, back in those days, it was mostly his's. There were not many women who were cartoonists. But they were getting together all the time, whether it was small dinners or larger cocktail parties or golfing. So you know, everyone was pretty much aware of what the others were doing. And it was a collegial group, by and large. It wasn't cutthroat competition. And my recollection is that when some ill befell one of the cartoonists, there was always one or more among the group who was willing to step in and help. Now, I remember vividly my father in probably around 1960 came down with pneumonia. And this was, this was ancient times. When you had pneumonia, you went to a hospital. They put a big oxygen tent around you. People these days probably don't even know what an oxygen tent is. And, he'd be sitting in his bed with the oxygen tent around him. And, of course, he couldn't work. And what are you to do? You might be out of commission for several weeks, and the syndicate, which distributes the strips, is wondering, where are the strips? And in that situation, a cartoonist named Stan Drake, who did a strip called The Heart of Juliet Jones, which at the time was also very, very popular, he stepped in and he drew my dad's strip for him for a period of several weeks. Now, that kind of act was not a novelty, and it was not a single example. This sort of thing was happening all the time.
You had mentioned a brief list, but just looking at the strips that were coming out of this very tight-knit group, as you mentioned, Superman, Beetle Bailey, Snuffy Smith, Rip Kirby, Hagar the Horrible, High and Lois, Nancy, Sam and Silo, Amy, The Wizard of Id, The Heart of Juliet Jones, Family Circus, Joe Palooka, The Lockhorns. These are some of the most iconic and, long-lasting comic strips, many still in production by either family members or other artists who have taken them over. They still live.
They do. Comic strips have a remarkable longevity. There are strips like Gasoline Alley or the Cats and Jammer Kids that are, a century old or older or nearly a century old. And to grow up among all of these strips, it was a little bit like growing up with a certain kind of visible cultural history as just woven into your childhood life. And I remember being aware of it as something that was very special and unusual at a very young age. It was hard not to understand that your life was a little bit different from the life of other people. My father was always home when I came home from school, as were the fathers of other kids who were children of cartoonists. How many kids were able to say that? Most of the people in Fairfield County, the white-collar people anyway, were going to New York and working as bankers or in Madison Avenue or something like that. When it came time to give people presents, the cartoonists always drew things for one another. And, in my boxes and files and on the walls, I have lots of these wonderful drawings. They didn't go out to the store and buy something. They drew something. So there was a sort of creative ferment that characterized the environment. One of the things about longevity of comic strips, I think, is simply that the way they're constructed, this combination of words and pictures, really appeals to something that the human mind likes. I can't get into the science and won't, but there's something about the way our heads are wired that makes us very responsive to that 1-2 punch of picture and text. It's very efficient. You can tell a joke very quickly. You can tell an adventure story at a very fast pace. And I think that contributed a great deal to their, you know, to their staying power.
As you mentioned, your father received training from Norman Rockwell. As I mentioned in the introduction, you will be at the Norman Rockwell Museum on Saturday. What were the Norman Rockwell stories like that you grew up with?
My father had the great good fortune to grow up not far from Norman Rockwell in New Rochelle. They lived on the same street, one house or two houses apart. I remember the house very well. And Rockwell, at one point, when my father was probably 9 or 10 years old, saw him on a playground. My father at that time had a shock of red hair. He looked like, you know, just what you imagine a Norman Rockwell kid looks like, and somehow caught Norman Rockwell's attention. And Rockwell went to his mother later that afternoon and said, "Would you mind if I asked Jack to model for me?" And his mother said, "Yeah, well, sure." So my father did begin to model for him, and at the same time also began to learn a lot about drawing and about illustration. My dad had had ambitions to be an artist before knowing Rockwell, and this took the whole ambition several steps further. Rockwell used to give my father short stories to illustrate, you know, often Hemingway short stories. And, you know, he'd say, "Well, here's one. Here's The Killers, for instance. Go see what you would do if you were going to illustrate The Killers." And my father would go back to him with a, you know, with a sketch for a painting, and Rockwell would work with him on the composition and so on. And then my father would go off and take it another step or two. So that kind of informal, you know, training just in afternoons was very important to Dad. I actually have a sketch that Rockwell did in which he was, you know, trying to explain to my father, you know, how to get the composition right for a particular painting. And then Rockwell helped my dad get into the Art Students League in New York and arranged for a scholarship for him. And that, too, was hugely important to my father. There's at least one Saturday Evening Post cover that has my father on it. There's a mural in New Rochelle that has my father in it. And they were in touch, you know, for the remainder of Rockwell's life.
You can see in the book, you can see really the influence that Rockwell had on your father's art.
Yes, indeed. And not just Rockwell, but you know, very much Rockwell, but that entire school of people, of which Rockwell was one exemplar. Howard Pyle and J.C. Leyendecker would be two others that my father admired. And the Norman Rockwell Museum has had big exhibitions on both Leyendecker and Pyle, which is certainly a recognition of that great general school of illustration that they were all part of.
Well, you will be at the Norman Rockwell Museum on Saturday afternoon, and I assume talking about much of what we were talking about today.
All of this and more, and I hope we'll have a good turnout, and it should be a very fun occasion. I love that museum.
Again, the name of the book is Cartoon County, My Father and His Friends in the Golden Age of Make-Believe. The event takes place on Saturday, the 9th of December at 2 o'clock, and you can find out more information by going to nrm.org. For Norman Rockwell Museum, nrm.org. Colin Murphy, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe. I've enjoyed it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Cartoon County, John Cullen Murphy and His Friends in the Golden Age of Make-Believe. Their event is Saturday, December 9th at 2 o'clock at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Find out more at nrm.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.